You may be wondering why we're tackling the tale of Esther today. That's a good question. And there are a lot of reasons why I thought this was the right next book for us as a church family. For one, it seemed like it was already time to get back into the Old Testament and make Keegan struggle over some of these names. We were in Paul's two letters to the church of the Thessalonians for 5 months of this year. It seemed like a good idea to jump right back and learn some more from the First Testament, which the Lord gave us for our instruction. And on top of that, Esther seemed like the right next book of the Old Testament. I was going to preach Ezra next in our ongoing series of the big story in the Old Testament, which we've actually been in this series since 2003 when we started Genesis. But in recent years, we've done 1st and 2nd Kings, then we did Jeremiah, which carries the story on. In the winter and spring, we did Daniel. Well, what's next? Ezra, right? We saw back in Daniel in the winter and spring that the events of Ezra had already begun while the book of Daniel was unfolding. So Ezra would make sense. But Esther is another book that, like Daniel, tells a story of the Jews in exile. The entire story takes place far away from the promised land. And like Daniel, we learn in Esther how to live in a kingdom that is far from the kingdom that has been promised to us. I think that was helpful to learn about in the winter, and it would be good for us to think about some more as the next winter approaches. There are a lot of similarities between the book of Esther and the book of Daniel. I'm glad we're doing them both in the same year. But there's also a lot of differences. In Daniel, there were a lot of miracles circumventing the laws of nature, right? Remember all the miracles in Daniel? Well, in Esther, there are none. In Daniel, there were lots of visions revealing the future. In Esther, there are none. And here's the biggest difference. In Daniel, there were lots of names used for the one true God. In Esther, there are none. The name of God does not appear in the book of Esther. That's one of the most amazing things about this book. It's in the Bible, but the Lord is not named in it. If you remember, just about every message in Daniel, I picked a different name for God from that chapter to be the title of that message in that chapter. The God of heaven, the King of heaven, the God of gods, he who lives forever, the Ancient of Days. Not one of those names appears in the book of Esther, and no other name for him appears in the book of Esther. And I don't think that's a coincidence. That's not a minor thing in this book. That's a major thing in this book. This book does theology without ever talking directly about theos, about God. God seems conspicuously absent. I think that's on purpose. Some people have thought that maybe the book of Esther doesn't even belong in the Bible because it doesn't mention God. It's just an interesting story from Israel's history. But both the Jews and the church have disagreed with that idea. God's people through the ages have recognized this story is a sacred story. It belongs in Holy Scripture because God inspired it to help us when we feel this question. Where is God? Have you ever felt that question? I know you do. Where is God when bad things are happening to me? Where is God in this day and age? Where is God in this situation that I found myself in? Why does it so often seem like God is not here? In many ways, the book of Esther is a lot easier to relate to than Daniel. Because I don't know about you, but I've never gotten a vision from God. I don't think I've seen a physical miracle, not from my eyes. But I've lived in a world where I wondered if God was even there. The world goes about its business acting as if God was not present. And sometimes, often, it feels like it. Is God here? Is God at work? Sometimes he sure seems invisible and quiet. Where is God? The tale of Queen Esther answers that question with subtle genius. It doesn't just come out and say the answer. No. It allows you to feel the question on every page and to feel your way to the hope-filled answer by following this rollicking good story. This is one of the greatest stories of all time, is it not? It's got it all, doesn't it? Political intrigue, money, sex, and power in the halls of the king, twists and turns that you would never see coming, amazing reversals, tragedy and violence, brutality, comedy and humor, even physical humor. There is so much irony and satire in this story, especially in how the storyteller paints the characters, how foolish some of them are, how wicked some of them are, and how brave some of them become. This is one of the greatest stories of all time. There's a reason why Esther is so many people's favorites. How many of you, go ahead and tell me, how many Esther is your favorite book in the Bible? Yeah, a bunch of you. Yep. Yeah, I will try not to bungle it for you as I retell it. It all begins at a party. Once upon a time. Look with me, please, at Esther chapter 1, verse 1. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes, the Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. What a great opening line. You can just hear the storyteller start the story. The storyteller places this story in history and geography, right? It happened during the time of Xerxes. Your Bible may say Ahasuerus, same guy. His Hebrew name is Ahasuerus, or actually more woodenly translated from the Hebrew, it would be Akashwerosh, okay? That's a mouthful. And nearly everything points toward him being the same king that is known in the Greek language and Greek history as Xerxes the First, Xerxes the Great, who reigned from 486 BC to 465 BC. His name in Persian is even harder to pronounce. It's something like Kishayarshan. And Xerxes is the easiest to pronounce, so we'll just go with that. Same guy. I'll try to throw in the Hebrew name from time to time because that's actually here behind the NIV translation. It's the same guy. And the storyteller wants you to know who this guy is. They say, the Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. Now, where's that? That's from modern-day Pakistan. Okay, you got in your mind where Pakistan is? All the way to modern day Ethiopia or even northern Sudan. This guy was a big deal in geopolitics for a few decades in the 5th century BC. And kind of like Nebuchadnezzar, he was just about the king of kings of his day. It's that Xerxes, the storyteller wants you to know, that king. Now, what beloved nation was within his territory? From India to Kush, what's in between? Israel. It's not named, but we all know it. Xerxes was the high king over the nation of Israel. Remember, Israel was at this time a football, kicked back and forth between teams. That's probably important. Which kingdom was this one? Well, remember when Daniel got his vision and a bunch of his visions and there were different kingdoms that succeeded one another? Do you remember that from earlier this year? Like the one with the statue where Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold. What was the next metal? Silver. It was the chest and the arms of silver. And we said that was probably the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. Look at verse 2. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. Susa is in Persia, modern day Iran. Xerxes was the grandson of King Cyrus of the Medes and the Persians, the one who conquered Babylon the night of Belshazzar's feast. Remember that from Daniel chapter 5? King Cyrus had a daughter named Atossa and a son-in-law named King Darius the Great, who built up a great winter palace, a winter fortress really, in Susa. And King Darius and Atossa then had a son named Xerxes, and he took over and ruled a vast kingdom. But not every kingdom was in his domain. Can you guess which nation he was unsuccessful in defeating? No cheating if you already know your history. Take a guess here. Do you remember Daniel's statue again? There was the head of gold. Then he had silver. What was the next one? Bronze. That's right. That belly and thighs of bronze, which we said looked to probably correspond to the kingdom of, who was listening? Greece. Exactly. Yeah. The land of Socrates, who was born about this time. The land of Pythagoras. Do you guys remember Pythagoras's theorem back from your algebra class? He had been born and died by this time. And the land of Herodotus, the historian, who wrote a lot about Xerxes in his book about the Greco-Persian Wars. Xerxes wanted to conquer Greece. He wanted it really bad. In fact, that might have been what his banquet was all about. And what a banquet it was. Look at verse 3. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa, and in the third year of his reign, probably 483 BC, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the provinces were present. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. I think we're all supposed to go, ooh. We're supposed to be impressed. That is one long party, right? A banquet that lasts 180 days. That's half a year, right? 6 months. The word translated banquet in verse 3 and in verse 5 is mishta. And it shows up in Esther more than anywhere else in the whole Bible. Mishta. The storyteller of Esther uses it 20 times in these short chapters, and it only shows up 44 times in the whole Old Testament. So almost half of them are in this one book. The whole story turns on what happens at these mishta, banquets or feasts. There are like 10 banquets in these 10 chapters, and every one is entertaining and important to the story. So whenever there's a banquet, pay attention. This is the longest banquet in the book, and it has all these military people at it, which leads a lot of readers to think that this is a political rally to get Xerxes' armies all psyched up to go attack Greece. For 6 months, they party. Maybe that's an exaggeration, or it's kind of like this is the whole time of the party. Maybe they work some and party some, but the whole festival is 6 months. I don't know. I do know that this party was an extravaganza, right? For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. And when that party was over, he threw another party. Verse 5. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet, mishta, lasting 7 days, in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people from the least to the greatest who were in the citadel of Susa. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry. One version says red feldspar. That also is something I don't know what that is. Okay, must be amazing. Marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Do you feel the ostentation? Do you sense the opulence? Do you see the glitz? This banquet isn't kingdom-wide, the second banquet. It's back home at Susa. And the king has opened up the doors of his palace to everybody in town. So thousands of people are coming through the palace. Everybody was welcome for 7 days to come and check out the home of the king. They've got the latest and the greatest stuff. They have couches made of gold, couches made of silver. Now, you may be wondering what a couch is. A couch is what we would call a couch. Like a thing that you sit on with pillows. They had so many of these that the historian Herodotus says that after the Persians left Greece in defeat, they left behind golden couches they forgot. Oh, rats, I forgot my golden couch. Not coins, not statues, but couches, golden couches. Now, before we go further, I've got to warn us all to be careful. Don't get too impressed here. Xerxes was trying to impress everybody in the kingdom. And it's easy to fall into it. I mean, just imagine walking through this party, especially if you're a normal person with a normal house and you see all this wealth on display. Wow. 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 But also think for a second about where all this wealth comes from. Nearly all of it came from unnecessary violence, from war, from setting out to conquer other kingdoms and bring back the plunder and start collecting the taxes as tribute. Yes, it's sumptuous, but it's also blood-soaked. It's so exorbitant. It's so excessive. Ugh. But the music is bumping and the wine is flowing. Do you see how much wine? Verse 7. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other. And the royal wine was abundant in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink in his own way. For the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. No two goblets were the same. Nothing mass produced. Everything is made by a craftsman to be unique. And everybody, at least all the men, could drink as much as they wanted. The bar never closed. I think the point of verse 8 is that they didn't have to drink just when the king drank. Often the rule was, in monarchies like this, if the king is drinking, you're drinking. And if the king puts his cup down, you put your cup down. But at this banquet, the king said, "Don't pay any attention to me, guys. Drink as much as you want. The only law here is you've got to drink what you want for a whole week." What could go wrong? A bunch of men drinking as much as they want for 7 days. King Ahasuerus was showing off. I think we're going to soon see that the story of this banquet is a story of foolishness. So I have 3 points of wisdom I think we can glean from Esther chapter 1. And here's the first one. Don't be fooled by the big show. Not everything that glitters is gold, they say, right? And even gold, real gold, isn't all that important in the grand scheme of things. In heaven, we're going to walk on the stuff. The world tries to convince us of its greatness with whatever's big, whatever's flashy, whatever's expensive. Social media images make things look great, and then you order something online, and when it comes, it's so disappointing, right? Politicians make big promises and say how wonderful they are and wonderful everything's going to be if we just vote for them. Influencers show off their homes and cars and girlfriends and boyfriends and piles of cash. And we go, wow, wow, wow. Celebrities with their record deals, athletes with their clothing contracts. The world is trying to sell us something. Bright, bright are the treasures life may offer to me. We need to be wary, church. Xerxes was trying to impress everybody, but he was not an impressive man. Who are you tempted to be impressed by? And why? Not somebody else. Don't think about the mistake that your friend is making. Take the second to examine your own heart. Who are you tempted to be impressed by? And why? This creeps into the church too, right? We get impressed by the big church, the mega church, the pastor that's on the radio, the pastor who's on television, the pastor who's got the big, like, best social media presence, most exciting sermons, the worship band that really bumps, or whatever the kids say today. You know what I mean. The most books sold, no matter what's in the books. The most followers. Don't be impressed by the big show. This feast reminds me of Belshazzar's feast from Daniel chapter 5. Do you remember that? That was the day that Xerxes' granddad killed Belshazzar of Babylon and took over his kingdom. What were they doing that day? Drinking it up. Acting as if the Lord did not exist. Are these people here at this banquet thinking about the Lord? No way. He's the furthest thing from their mind. If you brought it up, they would say, "Where is God?" All they can think about is money and power and drink and probably sex. Because here's what comes next. By the way, if you know this story, and most of us do, try to pretend for the next few weeks like you don't when we read it. Try to think what it was like to hear this story told to you for the very first time so you don't know what's going to happen next. It'll just increase your enjoyment and understanding of the book. The next thing is the queen. And her name is not Queen Esther. Her name is Queen Vashti. She too is giving a banquet. Verse 9, Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. It was in a whole other part of the palace. Now, we don't know much about this woman. She may be the same woman that the historian Herodotus names as Queen Amestris in his history books, but we're not for sure. At this point, this woman was the leading lady in Ahasuerus's harem and the queen of Persia, and she was beautiful. Some scholars believe that this banquet was a wedding banquet meant to celebrate Xerxes and Vashti's marriage. That's possible, but it doesn't say. It doesn't necessarily line up with what we get from Herodotus, so we're not sure. What it does say is that King Xerxes wanted Queen Vashti to leave the banquet for the women and come over to the banquet for the men who had been drinking and drinking and drinking. I can say it 7 times. Do you need to get the picture? Including the king himself. Look at verse 10. On the 7th day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, he commanded the 7 eunuchs who served him, Mahuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zether, and Carcass, to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. Xerxes was drunk. High spirits from wine, it says, right? The CSB says, feeling good from wine. Oh yeah. Not the best time to be making big decisions. But Xerxes did. He decides to call in his staff. Hey, you guys, get in here. 7 eunuchs who served him. And yes, they were most likely castrated so that they could be considered safe around the harem. Xerxes was a brutal king. He was not afraid to abuse and use people. He calls these 7 guys to himself. They have all hard to pronounce names. And many scholars that I read this week say that that's on purpose to bring out the comedic effect. The storyteller might have even changed their names for the book to make everybody giggle when they heard them. You know, oh, Bigtha, right? Agaptha. It's also comedic that the king sends 7 guys to collect 1 queen. Like something, like so much else in this story, it's outrageous overkill. It's going to take 7 guys to bring back Vashti. But what's not funny is why he wants her over there. He wants to show her off. He wants to display her beauty to a bunch of drunk men. I don't think that this is anything like the beauty of a bride on her wedding day. This is most likely showing off how smoking hot his trophy wife is. It's making her an object. It's degrading, insulting, humiliating. Treating his queen just like all his other property. He wants to use Vashti as further proof of his greatness. He wants everyone in the kingdom to envy him. And it's an assault on her dignity. Many Jewish readers came to believe, though it does not say this outright, that verse 11 implies that Xerxes wanted Vashti to appear at this banquet wearing only her royal crown. Xerxes was not a good king. He was not a good husband. He was not a good man. Don't be impressed by the big show. Now again, pretend for a second you don't know what happens in verse 12. What would the reader or the listener to this story for the first time expect to happen next, given what we've heard so far? This king rules from India to Ethiopia. He has just shown everybody what a great king he is. What do you expect to happen next? The queen will obey, right? She will obey her summons and follow, maybe be carried by the seven eunuchs from the women's banquet to the men's banquet and perform whatever duty the king requires. But that's not what happened. Verse 12. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. Now, we don't know why she said no. We can guess. But the Bible doesn't tell us. Perhaps she didn't want to be treated like a showgirl. Maybe she wasn't feeling well. Maybe she didn't feel safe. Maybe she was making a point. We don't know. It certainly was, whatever it was, a gutsy move. She was taking a big risk. Because she was bringing shame on King Xerxes in the thousands of eyes of his guests. And boy, did he hate that. Ooh, he got so angry that he didn't go and talk to her and solve this problem in their marriage. No, he called his buddies together and treated it as a problem for the whole nation. Look at verse 13. Since it was customary for the king to consult experts in matters of law and justice, he spoke with the wise men who understood the times and were closest to the king, Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marcina, and Memucan, the seven nobles of Persia and Media who had special access to the king and were highest in the kingdom. I think we're supposed to giggle at those names too. Seven more men. These are wise men. Perhaps astrologers and lawyers and definitely politicians, because they told him what he wanted to hear, not what he needed to hear. By the way, in this book, King Ahasuerus almost never makes any decision without consulting someone else. He could never make up his mind on his own. He has no moral compass. Sadly, Daniel has been dead for nearly 50 years, so Daniel's not in this bunch of advisors. And the king does not get good counsel. Verse 15. According to law, what must be done to Queen Vashti? He asked. She has not obeyed the command of King Xerxes that the eunuchs have taken to her. Often a bad sign when someone starts talking about themselves in the third person, right? These wise men are in a difficult position. The best advice would be for them to encourage their king to repent, to see his mistakes here, to sober up and apologize to the queen for putting her in that position. But that's not what they say. Look at verse 16. Then Memucan replied in the presence of the king and the nobles, Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and the peoples of all the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women. It's already on Instagram. And so they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come. This very day, the Persian and Median women of the nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end of disrespect and discord. The kingdom's going to fall apart. Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree and let it be written in the laws of the Persians and Media that which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. Also, let the king give her royal position to someone else who's better than she. Then, when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout all his vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands from the least to the greatest. This is terrible advice. Mamukin is trying to convince Xerxes that this will make their society fall apart if the word gets out that Vashti has shamed him like this. And his suggestion is that they spread the word that Vashti has shamed him like this. What? And he tries to convince the king to make a law that cannot be revoked, as if the king could never make a mistake in making a law, that Vashti will be banished from the king's presence. Which, by the way, she might have suited her just fine, right? That's what she wanted, right? She didn't want to see him that day, even though it came with a demotion, effectively a divorce. Notice that from now on, she's just Vashti, not Queen Vashti. And if he makes this law, then all the women of the kingdom will respect their husbands from the least to the greatest. Sure. That's what's going to happen? Just because there's a law now on the books, all the wives are going to do what Vashti did not do to the king? This doesn't make any sense. How are you going to enforce that one? He's trying to save face by legislating respect without earning it. And of course, Xerxes loved the idea. Great idea, Mamukin. Yes, yes, let's do that. I think Mamukin might have had trouble at home himself and was hoping that this would fix things there. Did you read the edict that came out today? Mamukin definitely was sending this message. The men of Persia will love you for this, O king. Look at verse 21. The king and his nobles were pleased with this advice, so the king did as Mamukin proposed. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in its own script, and to each people in its own language, proclaiming in each people's tongue that every man should be ruler over his own household. There, we told them. Here's lesson two for this foolish banquet. Don't be fooled into thinking that you're in control. Xerxes was not in control. He might have thought he was, but he was no such thing. He wasn't in control of himself. He was drunk as a skunk and making bad decisions. He wasn't in control of his wife. He didn't earn her respect and could not command it. He wasn't in control of his kingdom. You can't make the kingdom respect you by making up some law that says they must. You can't buy everyone's love either. He wasn't in control of his life or his destiny. What he did do made him look weak, ineffective, and silly. He was a joke. As the story goes, the emperor had no clothes. Don't be fooled into thinking that you're in control. And don't try to seize things that you can't or shouldn't. You know, some people, especially certain types of guys, read verse 22 and they say, that doesn't sound so bad. Every man should be ruler over his own household. Just sounds like biblical manhood to me. But the Bible never tells Christian husbands to subject their wives. The Bible never tells Christian husbands to make their wives submit to them. Now, yes, it tells Christian wives to submit to their Christian husbands as unto the Lord, 100%. But it never says that the husband is supposed to seize control. What's it say in that same passage? It says the husband is to love his wife as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. That's biblical headship. Xerxes wasn't saying that to the men of Persia. Xerxes was saying that women are second-class citizens, if they're citizens at all. Women are just objects to be used, abused, and consumed. Property to be shown off, prizes to be won and enjoyed. Women are something to be controlled. Brothers, don't be fooled. Sisters, don't fall for it. Women are to be cherished. Women are to be respected. Women are to be honored. And wives, husbands, wives are to be died for. Because our King, King Jesus, didn't kill to get his glorious majestic wealth. He was killed to give away his majestic wealth to his bride. And he's given us, King Jesus has given us the model for us to follow. Now we've gotten to the end of chapter 1. And we haven't even yet met anyone named Esther. The storyteller hasn't even mentioned the Jews yet, or Israel, much less God. It's just been these pagans with their pagan king and their pagan queen and their pagan drinking party. So, where is God? Where is God at the king's banquet? Is he there? Nobody's mentioned him. If he's here in this story, he's hidden. I think that's it. He is here, but he's hidden. Number 3 and last, don't be fooled into thinking that the hiddenness of God means that he's missing. God's not AWOL. Ahasuerus is not in control of his story. Who is? Whoever's telling the story is in control of the story, right? I wonder who's telling the story. Isn't it interesting that now the king has a new problem? He's going to wake up one day and realize that now I don't have a queen. There's a vacancy in my organization. It's kind of near the top over here. What am I going to do about that? And is it possible that someone who hasn't been named in this story is moving everybody around for his own purposes? Behind the scenes, so to speak? Is it possible that someone is not interfering with the story with signs and wonders and miracles? He's not saying anything. He's not sending everything, big things that wouldn't normally appear in a story, into the story. But he's just nudging everything into place and everybody into place for his own glory and the relief and deliverance of his people. I wonder, is it possible that someone is taking into account even the foolish choices of a drunk king and the dangerous choices of his previous queen and the stupid counsel of the 7 dummies, the 7 wise men, taking all that into account and weaving it into a story that will astonish and delight people in Pennsylvania 2,500 years later? Maybe someone is not missing. He's just hidden there in plain sight. Let's pray together.